Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. France is on high alert in deep mourning. Manhunts across the country and in Belgium. More bombing runs against ISIS in Syria. The Paris attacks are forcing a profound rethink on ISIS, its reach, its goals, and what it's planning next. The reasons for not going into Syria, its safe haven with troops on the ground to wipe them out or try to, have been obvious. Full-on war has been no miracle cure in Iraq or Afghanistan, but this can't go on. So what now? This hour On Point, the attacks in Paris and the way forward for Europe and the U.S. on ISIS. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you feeling these 3 days later? Do the Paris attacks change your mind on what to do about ISIS? So what should be done? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Paris is Sarah Miller-Yona, Paris-based Europe Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Sarah, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Hi, Tom.
Hi. We've just been hearing this morning, of course, the President of the United States in Turkey for the G20 meeting saying that the current strategy on ISIS is the right one and it's ultimately going to work. Is there confidence in France in that today, Sarah?
Well, I think, a lot of people in France woke up to hear that France had increased bombings on Syria. Up until now, that had really been contained. And I think that you're going to see a lot of public support for increased airstrikes there. I do not think that there's positive public opinion towards any sort of boots on the ground at this point. So I think in that sense, they're on the same page as the United States.
A state of emergency has been declared in France. What does that mean about how French police and other authorities can pursue potential suspects? We've heard about a lot of roundups and 150, 160 actions. I don't know exactly what they're doing. You tell us.
Well, there were raids all night last night, 168 across 19 cities. So it is as if the country's in a giant manhunt. There were 23 arrests, including a rocket launcher found in Lyon. The state of emergency is expected to last. It was for 3 days. President Hollande right now is addressing both houses of the parliament, and we'll find out exactly what it means for the French public. But for now, it is a very tense situation.
Is there fear in Paris of more attacks imminently?
Unfortunately, there definitely is, not just here, but across Europe. The Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, came on today saying that, they know that they're being planned at this very moment, and, we have to be aware of this. So, yes, I mean, terror threats are definitely up.
Belgium has appeared to be the source of a number of those active in carrying out or planning the attacks on Friday. Why Belgium? And what about the traffic between France and Belgium? Are there checkpoints there now, greater checkpoints, or none?
Well, the eighth attacker that has so far been identified actually is on the run. They tried to arrest him this morning. It ended up in no arrest. They still don't know where he is. But apparently, he was stopped by French police near the Belgian border and got through. So, it is a very difficult situation in that sense. Belgium has, it has the highest per capita of foreign jihadis going to Syria and Iraq to fight with terrorists. And, these neighborhoods, just like Paris, there's a lot of ghettos there, and it has been a hotbed. They believe that the mastermind of this attack on Paris on Friday is a Belgian living there. They believe he's in Syria now, but he was from there. And they also believe this is the same man who was behind the thwarted attack on the Thalys train that was thwarted by American servicemen.
The French president has called this an act of war, the attacks on Friday night. He has promised a pitiless response. What do you think that means to French people when they hear that, a pitiless response?
I think that that means that not only should they expect more airstrikes in Syria and Iraq, and remember, France has been the European nation that's really stepped up the most there. I think they also mean that, you know, there might be a lot more surveillance. There's going to be a lot more police presence. There's going to be these kinds of raids that go to neighborhoods across the country, disrupting life as we know it.
And what about tension between Muslims in France and others? There's been a lot of speculation that ISIS would hope to stoke and inflame tension there. It's only 3 days now, but scarcely that, since the attacks. What about the social relations in France, particularly across religious and demographic lines?
I mean, the social relations have always been tough. They've been tough since, you know, even tougher since 9/11, and then tough again after Charlie Hebdo and after, you know, all of the foreign fighters going to Syria and Iraq. It's early days still. The Muslims that I've talked to have said, you know, that they do fear getting targeted. They fear, you know, lots of things, that they're all going to be labeled terrorists, like happens after all of these kinds of attacks. We haven't seen any sort of, you know, targeting going on right now. But as a, you know, it is, the country's still in sort of a state of shock at this moment.
Is there an appetite there for putting French troops into Syria? We heard that the Paris wanted to do that, French Foreign Legion, but was unwilling to do it unless there were American troops. And of course, there are very limited American troops. Is there that kind of appetite in France?
I would not say that that's a mainstream view at this point. I mean, it may be something, you know, would have been unthinkable a year ago, and it is maybe something that will become part of the conversation. But the important point there is that, you know, they couldn't do anything without Americans. When, you know, the U.S. was about to airstrike Syria in 2013, France stepped up and said, we're going, and then Obama stepped back, and then France had to cancel it. So there really is nothing that's going to happen hugely in France without the support of the U.S., and I think we're very far away from that in the U.S.
Sarah Miller-Yonna, Europe Bureau Chief, Paris-based for the Christian Science Monitor, joining us today from Paris. Sarah, thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you.
I want to stay in Paris right here, if I may. Gilles Capel joins us right now, political scientist, specialist on Islam and the contemporary Arab world, professor at France's Paris Institute of Political Studies, or as it's known, Sciences Po. Gilles Capel, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You have expressed the view that in these attacks on Friday, France is paying the price for the blindness of political elites. Blindness to what, sir?
Well, blindness to many things. First of all, to the understanding of what is at stake in the Muslim world today. And I think our political elites are incapable to decipher the political language of Daesh, for many reasons, among other things, because studies of the Arab and Islamic world have been destroyed in France under Nicolas Sarkozy and François Hollande. And, you know, the French system has a sort of pyramidal government aristocracy, which does not care about anything except itself. So we're facing a major difficulty. I mean, France was a major center of Arab and Islamic studies. We had Louis Massignon, Jacques Berck, and a number of other people, Maxime Rodinson. Our students now are going to America or to Britain to have knowledge about this part of the world. And this is a catastrophe because we're a country where something like 5 to 8 million of our co-citizens come from Muslim families, come from North Africa. We are now in a major confrontation with what we here in France call Daesh or the Islamic State. Mm-hmm. And it looks like our political elites are at loss, which is a shame.
What about the American political elites? Let me play, if I may, just today at the G20 summit in Turkey, President Obama, the first question he got there from the press was from Agence France-Presse, asking if it was time for a change in strategy, given the Paris attacks. Here's part of the American president's response.
Our goal, as I've said many times, is to degrade and ultimately destroy this barbaric terrorist organization. As I outlined this fall at the United Nations, we have a comprehensive strategy using all elements of our power: military, intelligence, economic, development, and the strength of our communities.
Gilles Capel in Paris, as the President of the United States, saying the right strategy is being pursued, and he said it's ultimately going to work. Do you agree?
Well, there was something extremely important that took place in the G20 summit in Antalya, i.e. This sort of private encounter, the one-to-one between President Obama and President Putin. And this sort of made a decision, i.e. that they will find a solution for Syria. The quid pro quo was that the West would not insist on the immediate removal of Bashar al-Assad, and so they would work with the Russians against the Islamic State. And I guess that this is one of the consequences of the Paris attacks, that is to say that in spite of the sort of splitted coalition that you had against the Islamic State, Daesh, until now, when the French were bombing on their side, the Russians were bombing another target, the Americans were bombing a third target, then there will be a combined strategy against Daesh. And if there is no such strategy, it is impossible to destroy Daesh or the Islamic State. And, you know, maybe we'll discuss that later in the program, what we suffered in France on Friday the 13th and what we had suffered earlier on in January mm-hmm. with the attack on Charlie Hebdo and then on the hyper-kosher supermarket and the killing of the so-called apostate Muslim policeman was something that was possible because the terrorists have a great morale. I mean, they believe they are, in a way, they are resisting the biggest forces of the world, the biggest armies, the biggest coalitions, if I may say so. And even though they do not like Jews too much, they are like David against Goliath. And so this is something that that boosts, as I said, boosts the morale of a number of kids who come from the projects, who deal dope, who have no future, and suddenly they believe that they're in the center of the world, that they're redeeming society, and Daesh is a sort of catch-up for not only people from Muslim descent, but for also there's an enormous amount of converts amongst them.
Bells of Notre Dame there in honor of the dead in Friday's attacks in Paris. We're looking at those attacks and the way forward now for Europe, for the United States on ISIS. Gilles Capel is with us from Paris at the Paris Institute of Political Studies. Anthony Cordesman joins us in just a moment. You can join us as well. What is needed now in this situation, this conflict? I mean, in heartbreak and fury and fear, are you thinking war? What have we learned about war from almost 15 years in Afghanistan and Iraq? How can ISIS be effectively, intelligently stopped, ended? Here's a montage from the BBC of two witnesses who were in Le Bataclan at the time of the attack, that where most of the death happened, 80-plus, on Friday night.
I think they were just randomly shooting first in the dark into the mass of people, just destroy.
We were quite close to the stage, just dancing, you know. We heard a bang. People just screaming, shouting, screaming. They were just firing indiscriminately into the crowd, you know.
A random massacre. It lasted a lifetime, or an eternity. It was like probably an hour.
129 dead on Friday, many critically injured. The death toll has climbed since then. In an address to the nation, France, on Saturday, President François Hollande blamed ISIS or Daesh for the attacks.
Face à la guerre, le pays doit prendre les décisions appropriées.
Faced with war, the country has to take appropriate steps. It's an act of war committed by a terrorist army, Daesh, an Islamist army, against France, against the values we uphold throughout the world, against who we are, a free country which speaks to the whole planet.
Gilles Capel joins us from Paris right now. From Washington, Anthony Cordesman is with us, Senior Fellow and Chair in Strategy, National Security Analyst, Center for Strategic and International Studies. Anthony Cordesman, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
The President has said in Turkey today that the U.S. and its partners have the right strategy, that it's ultimately going to work after what we saw on Friday. Do you agree?
Well, I think you need to be very careful. In broad terms, he's made a very general statement. In practice, Before these attacks, we were making very significant changes in the way we were conducting the air campaign. We had also made some very significant shifts on the ground. Part of these became public when they announced that you were sending in 50 special forces to work with the Kurds in Syria. And that was critical in the actions in the Sinjar area that shut the main road to Mosul. But you also are considering relatively significant changes in the broader train and assist mission. Yesterday, for the first time, one of the Pentagon spokesmen explained in detail what the U.S. train and assist camps were in Iraq, and those, too, have changed significantly in the level of effort. If you're defining the strategy as being constant and that you're not sending in major combat units on the ground, I think you need to remember that this isn't the U.S. simply dealing with ISIS or ISIL. In Iraq, you have an ongoing struggle between Sunni and Shiite, Kurd and Arab. You have Shiite factions and militias in addition to a central government force, an Iranian presence, and you have the problem of moving units in and supporting them, which takes time. In Syria, basically, the major fighting isn't with ISIS. It's on the ground, and it's between Arab rebel factions and the Assad factions supported by Iran, the Hezbollah, and Russia. And moving into that area requires you essentially to go in through Turkey, which is a long, time-consuming process, and then intervene in a civil war where basically it's not clear anyone wants you. So in that sense, it isn't a matter necessarily of having the right strategy. We're obviously changing key elements of it. But what you don't really have is the option of sending in ground forces.
We saw an attack on ISIS in Libya overnight, air attack. We saw U.S. airplanes, I'm reading here, taking up maybe 100 trucks full of oil, a significant source of revenue for ISIS. These appear to be significant escalations planned before the Paris attacks, Anthony Cordesman.
Well, as I said, you were changing the air campaign. You basically, these oil attacks sound a little more impressive than they really are. We have not been striking against these trucks, or actually several thousand of them we will have to eventually hit, but we were also hitting the actual oil facilities before this. And I think, yes, you had begun this escalation, and one of the key questions really is this attack in Paris to some extent a reaction to the fact that ISIS was encountering considerably more serious problems in terms of the air attack and the Kurds? There'll be no way to know unless we can get a much clearer picture of their intention. But you did point out something that's very critical, and that's that ISIS was carrying out attacks inside Libya. And one thing that you have to remember about what happened in Paris is that you've had these attacks in the Middle East in similar form for months, and in North Africa, and probably at least one major attack inside of Turkey. Mm-hmm. And they're sometimes described as being very sophisticated, but in fact, all of the technologies used are technologies that have been used before, and coordinating the attacks involved requires something on the order of a digital watch. We really have a problem when we think that you can somehow contain or prevent this type of attack entirely. You can certainly reduce it. You can take the measures France is taking. But ultimately, will they be able to attack? Will other movements be able to attack with some success? And much more broadly than in France, I'm afraid the answer is yes.
We're looking for an effective way to respond to that ongoing threat. Anthony Cordesman with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, thank you very much for joining us for a minute today.
Pleasure.
Yesterday, Congressman Adam Schiff of California, this is a ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, talked to ABC News saying that being on defense is not enough.
This is not just an intelligence failure. It's a failure also of a coalition campaign because we have allowed ISIS to have sanctuary in Syria and Iraq. And unless that changes strategically, we can expect more attacks like this. It has the aspiration to attack us here at home. And being on defense through the use of these intelligence resources is simply not enough.
Jeb Bush maybe went further on Meet the Press, talked about what the U.S. response to the Paris attacks ought to be. Jeb Bush.
We should declare war and harness all of the power that the United States can bring to bear, both diplomatic and military, of course, to be able to take out ISIS. We have the capabilities of doing this. We just haven't shown the will.
Declare war, says Republican Jeb Bush. Not enough, says the Democrat on the Intelligence Committee there. Joe in Wilmington, North Carolina. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What do you see?
I think that NATO should, France, Germany, England, Western countries, I don't care if it takes 500,000, a million, they need to go into Syria and Iraq, clean it out. Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries should bankroll it because they finance some of these radicals, the Sunnis. This will send a message to the radical Shiites that we're serious and we have to be willing to stay there long term, like after World War II with the Nazis and the Japanese, and rebuild the country and get the peaceful people in the positions of power and not leave after a year and then all the slugs come crawling out from under the rocks.
Joe, we've got it. I mean, we put a lot of troops and a lot of money and a lot of years into Iraq already, but you say it's time to go back and go maybe even heavier. I want to go to Roelmark Gerecht. He joins us right now. Gilles Capel, please stand by in Paris. Roelmark Gerecht is senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, former CIA case officer, big focus on the Middle East. Roelmark Gerecht, welcome. Thank you for being here. What do you say to Joe's suggestion? Full on, heavy duty, half a million troops, Saudis bankroll it, Japan, Germany style, World War II style. You know, it is not uncommon right now after these Paris attacks for people to say, roll in heavy.
Well, I mean, in theory, it's a nice idea. I don't think the Europeans, for example, just simply don't have that type of throw weight. Their militaries have been reduced consistently since the end of the Cold War, and even during the Cold War, many of them didn't have much. The welfare states in Western Europe have essentially eaten the military. France has more than everybody else, with the possible exception of Great Britain, but even they cannot sustain combat for any length of time unless the United States aids them. So if there is going to be a greater military action, if there's going to be action on the ground, it's going to have to be led by the United States. Arab armies are, for the most part, worthless. They logistically simply can't go beyond their borders for any period of time or with any strength. So the notion you're going to have a combined Arab force do this, I think, is delusional. And also the Kurds, we've been trying to encourage the Kurds to do more in Iraq and Syria. I think that's probably a mistake. There aren't enough Kurds, and the Kurds really don't need to get themselves into trouble by fighting in areas which are heavily Arab. So I think that's limited. So this really does come down, I think, to the United States and our willingness to exert ourselves. I don't think it's pretty clear with President Obama that he is in favor of using ground troops in any measurable means, either in Iraq or in Syria. So I think it's really a question of whether we absorb more strikes. And if there will come a point where the United States gets hit, it won't be the Europeans, where we finally say enough is enough and we change our policy.
Gilles Capel in Paris, what do you see as the smartest way to go forward here? There's a call from our first caller for a heavy military footprint. What do you think is the smartest way? How important is this G20 Putin-Obama agreement on Syria's future? What's the smartest way ahead here, Gilles?
Well, this agreement is absolutely crucial because if there is no agreement between Russia, which in a way is the head of the Shia coalition, which has Iran and Bashar al-Assad in its ranks, and the West, there is no way to destroy the what you in America call ISIS or ISIL or ISIL, mm-hmm, and we call Daesh or the Islamic State. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if what is being talked about at the Antalya G20 summit is implemented, then we can see the possibility of the termination of the Daesh so-called caliphate. Because as long as we have this caliphate, so-called caliphate, in between Mosul and Palmyra, in the sort of Sunni heartland of the Levant, then we'll go on having problems in Europe. You know, for those third-generation jihad people, Europe is now the soft underbelly of the West. This is their target, and this is how they are. They're different from the second generation, from the Bin Laden, from the Al-Qaeda people, who decided that targeting America was the thing to do. That was 9/11. But then those young people consider that 9/11 was a major mistake. It was hubris on the part of Bin Laden, because it provided America with the possibility, the legitimacy, to find the military, the financial, the political resources to lash out at Al-Qaeda and weaken it tremendously. So they have a different strategy now. America is not their prime target. The prime target is Europe. And they want to mobilize young disenfranchised people from Muslim descent or recent converts to Islam in order to promote a civil war in Europe in order to destroy the country. So it's a bizarre ideology. It's because you know, it's a hubris on their part also. But nevertheless, as long as you have this ISIS stronghold that remains, with those groups of young people who fight against the mightiest armies of the world, this will bring more recruits. Even though what happened in Paris in last Friday was a point of departure with what has happened in January. In January, they had targeted what they call Islamophobes, Jews, policemen.
Charlie
and
Hebdo.
Now it was just Charlie Hebdo. And so it created some sort of solidarity among some people from Muslim descent who said, je ne suis pas Charlie, I am not Charlie. Mm-hmm. Sheikh, which in colloquial Arabic means well done, you deserve it, or I am Charlie Koulibaly, the name of the killer of the hyper-kosher mm-hmm. supermarket. But this is very different this time because, this was a shooting spree. It was a rampage.
Indiscriminate.
Absolutely indiscriminate, and they killed everybody in an area of Paris, which is a sort of an area where young people go out on weekends, and where you also have an important, because it's a place where rents are not very expensive mm-hmm. by Paris standards. So you have a number of people from immigrant descent, mm-hmm. and amongst the people killed, you have a sort of sample of French urban society with a number of Arabs, blacks, Jews, homosexuals, what have you, you know. And therefore, it is when one looks at the social networks where while 1 year ago you had a number of people who said, you know, on their Facebook walls, I like the Kouachi brothers, the killers of Charlie Hebdo, or what have you. This is minimal this time. And though the constituency that the terrorists want to mobilize in order to back them is reduced to close to nothing, to just to the core group of the militants. So on the one hand, you have it's a tactical success for them because they kill so many people. But on the long term, or in the middle term, or the middle range, on the strategic level, it may be, the step too far. They may have crossed a red line. You know, there's a political economy of terrorism. If terrorist attacks are unable to gather followers for their cause, then they fail. When you think of the first generation of jihadism in the 1990s in Algeria and Egypt, they failed. And because they just killed the people they hoped to mobilize. The same was true after 9/11 with the copycat attacks in London, in Madrid, and so on and so forth.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the attacks in Paris and the way forward now for Europe, for the United States, on ISIS. Roelmark Gerecht is with us, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, joining us from Washington. Gilles Capel is with us, political scientist, specialist in Islam, the contemporary Arab world, with us from the Paris Institute of Political Studies. You can join us this hour. What do you think? How can ISIS be effectively, intelligently stopped, ended? What would you do on troops, on refugees, on diplomacy? Will this attack get Europe, Russia, the United States all on the same page? And how do we actually robustly, intelligently turn this around? The president of France, François Hollande, just this morning, addressing a very rare joint session of parliament at the Palace of Versailles, says, act of war.
La France est en guerre.
France is at war.
Les actes commis
the acts committed on Friday evening in Paris near the Stade de France were acts of war. At least 129 people were killed and many people were injured. It represents an attack, an aggression against our country, against its values, against its youth, and against its way of life.
Pretty big language there at Versailles. On Saturday, Republican Florida Senator Marco Rubio went further, said this is a clash of civilizations.
What we're involved in now is a civilizational conflict with radical Islam. This is not a geopolitical issue where they want to conquer territory and it's two countries fighting against each other. They literally want to overthrow our society and replace it with their radical Sunni Islamic view of the future.
We've heard clash of civilizations before. We've gone to war. It hasn't brought peace on earth. Here's the president in Turkey saying the U.S. should respond in a careful way when it comes to troops.
When we send troops in, those troops get injured. They get killed. They're away from their families. Our country spends hundreds of billions of dollars. And so, given the fact that there are enormous sacrifices involved in any military action, it's best that we don't, you know, shoot first and aim later.
The president today in Turkey at the G20 meeting there, yes, lots of conversations with Putin and others, but also still this cautious note on the military front. Rich in Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you for calling, Rich. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment, possible solution. I don't know. You know, this is such a difficult situation.
Yeah.
Because there is no, you know, geographical area that we're really after. We're after a militant group that is basically using tactics of guerrilla warfare. And my father fought in the French underground, and he told me that before he passed away that, you know, the guerrilla warfare is probably the most difficult type of warfare to overcome. And I think we need to fight fire with fire. We need to infiltrate ISIS. We need to, and this will take time, and through concerted efforts of, you know, the industrialized nations, if you will, you know, have to work towards infiltrating their strongholds, you know, find out where their strongholds are and systematically attack them. This is a problem that's not going away. Something has to be done, and it has to be done soon, because this is a problem that's going to come to the United States if it hasn't already, and it's going to get only worse. It's not going to get any better.
Rich, I appreciate your call very much. Roelmark Gerecht, the president there expressing caution on military deployment, and of course many Americans understand and sympathize with that after what we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. But, you know, here's another caller, Rich, saying this is going to get worse. Something's got to be done. Now, Gilles Capel looks at the agreements that are being worked out at the G20 meeting in Turkey and sees hope for the termination of the Daesh Caliphate or of ISIS as an entity. Do you share that hope or maybe even optimism with these agreements? And what would that actually take?
I'm not terribly optimistic about that because probably the root cause of the Islamic State's strength in Syria is in fact the Assad regime and its allies, principally the Russians now, mm-hmm. and the Iranians. So they started this mess by attacking those who were objecting to the oppression of the Assad regime. It has evolved a long way since then. But I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of Sunnis in Syria, that we're talking about 70% of the population thereabouts, are in the opposition and de facto on the side with the Islamic State. So I don't see any type of Shiite alliance, Russian-led Shiite alliance in Syria that is going to end the Islamic State's presence in Syria. In fact, to the extent that they engage in further violence against the Sunni community, and that's what they're doing on a daily basis, it improves the position of Sunni militants in the country. So I don't see that really working. Again, I think the question here is for the United States is tolerance of pain. Obviously, President Obama came into office quite determined to retrench America's position in the Middle East. He obviously has trouble with the idea of American hegemony in general. And I think he's been very consistent about that. So I think the odds of him reinserting any measurable American military power into the Middle East on the ground is—it just simply isn't going to happen.
Which leaves me still not hearing the way in which Daesh, ISIS will be dealt with. Gilles Capel, I want to come to you on what the machinery of that termination might be, if you see it as a possibility now. One call here first, and I'll come to you. Saeed in Green Bay, Wisconsin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a fundamental lack of appreciation for the nature of the conflict that we're engaged in on the part of the West. This is at its core an ideological war. And we see the front lines of this ideological war, for example, in the experiences of Malala in Pakistan, or the uprising of the Green Movement in 2009 for people asking for rights in Iran. This is an ideological war at its core.
But ISIS has a kind of an apocalyptic view of the world. They want a caliphate and maybe the end of the world as we know it. Is that, I guess it's an ideology, but it doesn't seem just freedom related. It certainly doesn't seem like that of Malala in Pakistan.
Yeah, but let me explain. We are good at winning military engagements after having spent billions of dollars in ridding in military investment and ridding the Soviets from in Afghanistan. We were unwilling to spend $10 million building schools there. We defeated Taliban. We have defeated Al Qaeda at times, and now ISIS. And if we, when the heat mm-hmm. gets bad enough that we develop the national will, we will prevail over ISIS as well. But then there will be another entity, and another entity, and another entity, unless we address the ideological war. We have to win the ideological battle. Without it, we are in an endless series of military conflicts.
So let us pick that up. That seems pretty daunting. Our efforts on that front have seemed pretty ham-handed, to put out some videos about how Gilles Capel, how do you look at the ideological face of this and then the practical face? You said you foresaw the potential of the termination of the Daesh caliphate in this agreement in Turkey. What would the machinery of that be? How important is the ideological face of it?
I don't know whether it will be terminated or not, and Ruhl is, of course, very dubious about it. But there is no other way to start with the physical termination of the caliphate.
Who will do it?
Ideology will come afterwards. Ideology functions and is lively because there is a territory, because there is a morale, because you have all those videos of Islamic State fighters who behead unbelievers, hypocrites, whatever you want. And if the ground for the so-called ISIS caliphate is destroyed, this will be a major setback for the mobilization of European jihadists.
But how would that happen practically, Gilles? The rule says not the Kurds, they're doing too much already, not the U.S., solidifies opposition,
well,
the Russians, the back Assad.
This was until now. Mm-hmm. But then, even though I understand rule is dubious about about the will of President Obama to go forward in the Middle East, and as he said, is rather willing to retrench America. Nevertheless, I believe that what happened at this G20, which is still happening, this G20 meeting in Antalya in Turkey, is a shared will by most participants there that enough is enough, that people who within the G20 had backed the Islamic State, even though they did not say it, like, for instance, the Turks facilitated the crossing of the border, from, or turned a blind eye at least to the fact that so many Europeans were crossing the border from Turkey into the Islamic State. The oil that was extracted from the Islamic State lands was sold in Turkey and in other adjacent places. A number of people from the GCC, not necessarily the administrations themselves, the governments, but some well-connected people and rich people would fund the Islamic State or ISIS or whatever you call it, because they saw them as the major ally to destroy the Bashar al-Assad regime, which was in its stead one of the best cards that the Iranians could play in the Levant. You know, all those people had sort of mixed feelings, and they said they paid lip service to the opposition to the Islamic State, but with the other hand, they would fund them. Now, after the Paris attack, I would believe that things have changed a little, and in a way, and then I agree with Ruhl, I believe that in the G20 meeting and in the Putin-Obama encounter, the proposition power, if I may say so, is Russia. Russia managed to play its card quite adroitly and skillfully in Syria. They said they would bomb Daesh. Actually, they bombed mainly the opposition that to Bashar al-Assad that was supported by the West. They weakened them. And now they're telling the West, hey, guys, we have Daesh on the one hand and Bashar al-Assad on the other hand. We don't like that Bashar al-Assad that much, you know, but he's the lesser of two evils. And why don't we join forces and destroy Daesh? Who's such a threat to you, to the West?
Would they give up Assad, Gilles Kepel? Would Russia give up Assad if that's part of the deal here? Leave his government perhaps in place, but not him?
Well, ultimately, they are not, you know, great lovers of Assad. I was in Russia last year, and I had a possibility to talk with a number of people at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they would tell me, you know, we can't let him down as of now because it would be perceived as a major failure of Russia, post-Soviet, if you'd like, policy in the Middle East. Because if we do so, we're zeroed in. Nevertheless, with this Bashar al-Assad guy doing his job in Syria, we have thousands of Chechens who are Russian citizens or Caucasian citizens who live in Russia, who are going there, who get trained, and who will go back to Russia and will plant more bombs.
So he's bad for them too, in a way. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and you know, since the Paris attack, I mean, friends from Russia are calling people they know in Paris and say, how was it? Or because, you know, the Bataclan, the theater in Paris that was attacked, was, of course, reminiscent of the attack on the theater in Moscow by Chechen Islamists a few years back.
Yes.
And therefore, Russia has its own agenda. They don't want to lose face in the region. But I believe they are interested in a solution which will save their own interests and that would not preclude those interests. They are not great fans of Bashar al-Assad. And they, if there is a sort of quid pro quo, they will take it. But as of now, they they were, you know, as opposed to governments of the West who despise the academy, strangely enough, in Russia, they have excellent Arabists. The former Prime Minister Primakov himself was an Arabist.
Permit me one more question, if I may, to Rule Makarecht. Sure. Rule, is there a recipe you see emerging here that might be effective? What does it look like? Does it look like Russia and the United States really cooperating?
I have to just express my skepticism here. I don't see it yet. I think that if there is a solution, it's because the United States has decided to become much more involved, to take the lead on this. I mean, I agree with Gilles completely that I think Paris is a turning point, certainly for the Europeans. But I don't think we find a solution until we have a very muscular transatlantic partnership. I don't think the Russians are the answer. I don't know.
Is Europe capable?
Well, Europe by itself, absolutely not. It's not capable.
So where's the muscular partnership?
That's the United States has to supply most of the muscle. I mean, that has been the transatlantic bargain since World War II. The Europeans simply aren't in a position to do that. They have, despite what happened in Paris, they have considerable, you know, counter-terrorist prowess at home. They are America's front line, and particularly the French are. But I don't see them operating effectively abroad unless the United States is there, and that means boots on the ground.
Maybe there's a solution emerging here, but I have to say I do not see it with clarity yet. Some changing chemistry here, maybe an important agreement in Turkey, but something that answers the scale of the challenge we've seen with the Russian plane, that we've seen in Ankara in Turkey, that we've seen in Beirut, that we've seen now in Paris. I don't hear it yet, but fascinating contemplation of what is emerging as the chemistry changes. Rule Makarecht at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And Gilles Kepel at the Paris Institute of Political Studies. Monsieur Kepel, thank you very much for joining us from Paris.
C'est un plaisir.
We will stay on it. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.